At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello everyone, welcome back to Talking in the Rain. My name is Sara Unju and today I have pianist Vicky Chow with me. She was born in Vancouver but moved to New York City. She is based out of Brooklyn right now and she just performed a sold-out show performing Philip Glass's Piano Etudes Book 2 here in Vancouver, and she is releasing the recording of that as an album this year, so keep an eye out for that. Vicky and I talked about her switch from classical to contemporary music, her disconnection with classical music, playing inside the piano, battling with notes, best relationships between performers and composers, improvising, her tattoos, her dog. But yeah, I'll let her introduce herself and enjoy the episode.
Welcome, Vicky. Thank you so much for joining me. Do you want to get started with a quick introduction? Tell us who you are, how long you've been playing the piano for, and maybe a musical artist or a genre you've been listening to lately.
Yeah, hi. My name is Vicky Chow, and I'm a contemporary classical pianist, originally from Vancouver, and now based in Brooklyn, New York. I've been playing the piano for 35 years, so a very long time. And I listen to all sorts of music. I've been really into Aruj Aftab lately, a singer. I don't know how to describe her music, but her last album, Vulture Prince, was in my rotation a lot.
Nice. Would you say it's more like upbeat, a little more mellow?
It's a little bit more chill. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Very yeah. Beautiful vocals.
You said you've been playing the piano for 35 years. That is incredible. How do you keep the love, the passion you have going on for 35 years? I guess, how do you deal with burnout?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, when I started when I was five, and, you know, I was trained in the Western classical tradition, and I was going down this trajectory. You know, I made my orchestral debut with the Vancouver Symphony when I was 10, and I was performing with them every year, you know, when I was like throughout high school, up until when I left for New York in 2001 for my studies. I went to the Juilliard School. And like once I got there, I mean, it was my dream come true. I knew since I was 8 that I wanted to move to New York and study at Juilliard because, you know, it's the famous classical school conservatory. And I got in and once I got there, like the first few years was cool and was a little bit difficult. Like for me, my teacher at the school decided that, well, she teaches a very specific technique on the piano called Dorothy Taubman piano technique. And she introduced that to me like from the first lesson on, and it completely changed my technique and approach to the instrument. And it was really awkward for a long time because, you know, I had just built up my own, you know, intuitive technique through playing repertoire growing up. And then all of a sudden, you know, someone's like, oh, actually, you should be moving your hands like this or using your arms like this. It was completely counterintuitive. And I had to relearn how to play, which in some ways it was really difficult, emotionally, you know, just cause, you know, I got there and I was like ready to fly, you know, and work on all this amazing music, and then all of a sudden I had to kind of step back and work on the fundamentals again. So that was really challenging, but I did that for the first few years, and I think I kind of got the hang of it. I incorporated it into my playing, and then I started kind of questioning the repertoire, the classical traditional canon, on the piano. You start with Bach and you kind of end in like the early 20th century, like what's contemporary is like Prokofiev, or Bartok. That's like already like, everyone's like, oh wow, you're playing Bartok, And that was what we were everyone was working on, like every student, every pianist that I knew. And I was just finding it unfulfilling. I think at some point as I was getting older, I found a disconnect with classical music, that it didn't give me the it didn't light my fire, and especially, like I was listening to a lot of different music. I really like electronic music, and I like jazz, and I was just finding, like just the musical style is just like starting to feel very dated. The music is written like, at least over 100 years ago, so I had a chance encounter with a friend of mine, who was a composer. His name is Joe Tien. I think he teaches somewhere in Michigan now. But he had a concert of his music, and his pianist dropped out like a week before, very last minute. So I saw him at school. He like ran into the elevator with me and was just like, "Hey, Vicky, like, can you please help me out? I have a concert of my music next week. I need a pianist. Can you jump in?" And up until that point, I've never really played any contemporary music before, music by living composers, just because the curriculum for pianists, like we just don't really focus on that. It's a thing in music schools that contemporary music is not really a focus, actually, which I think should change. And I think some schools have started incorporating that. But anyways, it was really nerve-wracking, because I only had a week to learn the music. Usually you spend the whole semester or the whole year like preparing for your juries and learning repertoire. So I had to learn something like really quick, which I've never done before. And so I opened up the score and then I realized, oh wow, like there's this like whole new musical world out there, like this new musical language, sounds and combinations of harmonies that I've never heard. Just completely opened my eyes, that there's a bunch of other music out there that I didn't know about somehow, that I was just in the dark. And so from that moment on, like I was like, okay, like I clearly like I felt that passion again, I felt that fire light up inside of me. And I decided that I want to do more new music and contemporary music. So I finished my master's at Juilliard and I decided to go up to the Manhattan School of Music. Just so happens, as I was graduating, they started a contemporary performance program. So that is a school that really embraced the new, and they dedicated an entire program. You can actually get a master's studying new music and contemporary techniques. And so I, Janet, kind of just like jumped into the deep end. Like I fell in love with new sounds, new works, new working with living composers, just discovering all this music that I didn't know about when I was just only focusing on the traditional canon. And I never looked back since. And that was, I think it's about like 15 years I've been doing it now. I've just been exclusively working on new music, contemporary music, music most definitely written in the past like 20 or 30 years. I commission composers to write pieces for me, things that utilizes and blends with uses of electronics and technologies, sometimes with video, sometimes with improvisation or free improvisation. And of course, like the different uses of the piano, like extended techniques, meaning like I would play inside the piano, muting and strumming, or prepared piano, like John Cage, like inserting different pieces of, I don't know, screws or objects to alter the sound of the piano strings. So I guess to answer your question about, how do I kind of fight burnout or, keep that fire alive? Like, I think, everything that I do is always new. It's always unknown. It could be a completely new works that someone just wrote for me, that I get to realize and bring to life. And that is exciting to me. And I feel like I'm doing important work and relevant work to continue the tradition of classical music because, Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata was at some point a new piece when he wrote it. And, now it's like part of the canon and it's like everybody knows it. And so, what gets me up every day is knowing that like I am the one getting to realize the works of composers living today, writing new classical works.
That is very exciting because with classical music, so much of the both like what's promoted on, I guess, like streaming websites or in person, what the orchestras are playing, they're mostly older works. And it's great that you're able to break that and bring out like shine a light on the newer works, which I think is very important because one has to think, like if we keep focusing on the older ones, how are the newer ones going to get to where the other ones are right now, basically. But yeah, so I have a question. You mentioned that you use different techniques, play differently, and you said playing inside the piano. Can you elaborate on that?
So, in the 20th, 21st century, a lot of composers started experimenting with like not just with the piano, but with other instruments too, like ways to play the instrument that isn't the traditional way, that isn't the correct way to play it. How do you extend the sound? This is kind of like it's become part of the piano technique now, where you can, pluck the strings. Like sometimes in some pieces, composers would be like, you need to, pizzicato, on a violin or something, pits inside the strings of the piano. You can also mute the strings and play it on the keyboard, so you get a kind of like a yeah muted piano sound. And you can use your fingers to do that. You can also use like blue tack, like those poster tack kind of putty things. You can place those on the strings and it would completely transform the sound. It's really cool. If you place it in different parts of the strings, sometimes you get different harmonics. You can do all sorts of things. Prepared piano is a very fun thing to do. John Cage, the American composer, was really the first one to really explore this idea. He wrote a set of pieces called the Sonatas and Interludes in 1946 to 48, and it's like 20 pieces. It's like an hour long, and he has an extensive instructions on how to prepare the piano. There are 88 notes on the piano. I think there are about half of it, like 44 of the notes are prepared, and some of the strings are prepared with two materials. Like, and he was very specific. He had measurements. He would say like 7 inches and 7¾ inches from the tuning pin. You want to place a screw between strings one and two, and then at 4 inches, you want to put, I don't know, a nut and bolt or something like that. Or he uses pieces of rubber or pieces of plastic. It's really cool. If you don't know Sonatas and Interludes, I would highly recommend to check that out. It, doesn't sound like the piano at all. It sounds like a gamelan, like a drum set from another world. It's yeah, and that is kind of the basis where a lot of people kind of jumped from. Like sometimes you can put even like tin foil or pieces of paper or on top of the string. So when you play it, there's like a little bit of a rattling sound. Oh, there's another American composer who sadly passed away recently, George Crumb, who also utilized a lot of inside piano techniques I think like one of in one of his pieces, it's a trio for amplified piano, flute, and cello. It's called Vox Balanae. It's like it's translates to voice of the whale. I think one of the techniques he asks the pianist to use is to use a chisel to slide up and down on the strings while you play it. So it creates a glissando effect. It sounds really silly, but it's really cool.
That all sounds. I did not know piano could be this experimental. That's incredible.
Yeah, it's pretty fun.
Oh yeah, sounds like it. And as someone who grew up, learning playing the piano in a classical way, doing these more experimental techniques, utilizing playing inside the piano, was that difficult for you to learn, or were you just so eager to do new stuff that it just kind of came to you?
I was very eager, that's for sure. And of course, yeah, like getting used to, getting inside the piano and seeing where all the strings are and like being able to, jump in and, pluck the correct string and all those things, like learning how to label and how to safely label and safely prepare the piano. All of that was very exciting, because like up until going to Juilliard, like I was just playing the piano. Like you've basically like I've mastered how to play the piano, and I think I'm a person who's very curious and I like to learn new things and discover new things. So all of that was just right up my alley. Like I just jumped right on it.
That's amazing. Have you ever wanted to learn a different instrument? Or have you started to learn a different one?
No, I dabble a little bit, but nothing serious. I think I want to be like a drummer, or a percussionist. Yeah, I think because, as a pianist, you are kind of a percussionist. You're using your fingers, which is kind of like mallets, and you're striking a key that hits a string. So it is a percussive instrument. So I think it translates well to percussion. Like I did at one point here in New York join a Balinese gamelan group, and I was playing gamelan, and that came very naturally to me actually, so that was really fun. And also like what was interesting about that because is that nothing is notated, everything is just you learn it by ear. I actually found that that way of learning was actually a lot faster and more efficient than learning through reading music. Like I often with new music, like I'm not really memorizing my pieces anymore, but obviously like for the traditional stuff, I used to memorize everything. And my memorization of pieces isn't definitely like, my top skill. Like that was something I was always very nervous about. And what I'm realizing was like, when I started doing gamelan, I was like, wow, like I learned these pieces like in that day, like in that hour, and it was just because someone was just playing by ear and I was mimicking and sh and immediately just went into my long-term memory. Like I didn't have a piece of paper where I had to read the rhythms and the notes. And that seems to be like the, I don't know, the gate or something. It somehow like that's an extra step. And removing that, like the music just went straight to my brain. Which was really cool.
That's very interesting because I have two things I wanted to mention. This made me think of one is I have two friends who are pianists. They also both play gamelan. And I wonder if that's like it's just generally an easier instrument for pianists to pick up. And so
I think so. With the movement, like the hand eye hand coordination. Yeah, I mean, I
Interesting.
also played, they had a like a wind instrument, I think it's called the suling. And I was, in the gamelan, you kind of rotate on different instruments. And when I had to play the suling, that I wasn't very good at. Like, I didn't have the breath work technique, So that was something that I wasn't so good at, but yeah.
Yeah. And the second thing I wanted to mention was, since you mentioned that you don't really memorize the pieces anymore, but I can only assume you practice before performances during rehearsals. Are you mostly during your rehearsals and I guess eventually in the performances, are you mostly sight reading or are you kind of categorizing like the sounds make sense in your brain? They're kind of clustered. What is that like for you?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm using an iPad to read my music as I play, but obviously I'm not sight reading it. You know, I have already practiced and, you know, I usually do a lot of run-throughs at home before performing. Yeah, so I mean, I think like the looking at the music as I'm playing, it's not like I'm reading it as I'm doing it. It's just to refer to it. Like, you know, it's like, oh, this is what's happening now, and like these are kind of the notes, and but I already know it. It's already been internalized. I think it's really mainly for like the structure of the piece, you know. You know, memorization, it's, you know, the person that started memorizing is Clara Schumann. You know, she was the one that like started that trend back in the day before people never memorized. And then because she started doing it, then all the pianists started doing it, all classical musicians started doing it. So we have her to blame for this. Yeah, I don't know, like it's definitely something that I'm not very good at, I have to admit, you know, like, you know, between you and I. It's something that it's like a muscle, I think, right? And that you need to keep practicing doing it. And for me, like I know I have some friends, some new music friends who, you know, go through the trouble of memorizing some of their music. And I think for some, that could be very freeing when they're performing, that they don't have to like look at the music and they know it and they can just play it. And I realize like for me, it's more of a hindrance that it would take away from me in my performing, the music. Instead of like focusing on the music, I think I would be it would just get in the way for me. Like, so I just decided that, you know what, like I know that that's not like my strong suit, and it's totally acceptable to be reading music, especially playing new music, that I will use my iPad to refer to the music as I'm performing, as long as like it's not detracting, I think, from my actual performance. And for me, like it actually, I think, like it helps me perform. So that's why I choose to do that.
Yeah. Does the iPad scroll on its own?
Oh no, I have a Bluetooth pedal. There are different companies that make this Bluetooth pedal that you can turn pages with your foot. Apparently, I've never tried this, but you can also use facial gestures. I've never tried it, but I think the app, I think they use like the camera in front of the iPad, and then like maybe if you wink or something, I don't know exactly, I've never done it, then it'll turn the page. But I feel that's a little bit scary. I think there's another one where, you know, you can, it's like a tube or some kind of thing, a button that you put in your mouth, and if you like chew a bite on it, then it'll turn the page. I've heard about this. I've never used it. I've never seen it, but.
Oh my God, I'm learning so much. For context, so I used to play the piano as a child, I feel like as most children do. And then I quit when I was like 12. So my knowledge of the piano stopped around like 14 years ago. And I found out that like pianists now use iPads and not actual paper, you know, notes from my friends. And this is even, wow, technology, man.
It's really funny. Sometimes when I have to go back to paper for whatever reason, now would like my foot would do this thing. Like, you know, even though it's paper, I would like step on an invisible pedal because I think that I'm using a pedal with an iPad and I expect the page to turn.
Do you
So
use
now.
your Do you use your left foot for the Bluetooth pedal?
Yes.
Yeah. Cool. Wow. That sounds honestly, yeah, that's very cool. Anyway, What is a normal rehearsal process for you?
I think the ultimate goal, is when you're leaving school after you've been studying, your instrument for so long, is that you want to you want to have your own interpretation and ideas of the music that you play. That is the ultimate goal, I guess, as a professional musician, is that you learn from your teachers, like how to interpret music, how to analyze music, how to practice music, and so, I've been out of school for a while, and I think like I have developed like my style or my way of approaching music and my way of interpreting music, and I think that's the thing that's exciting, is that, with new music, you are literally like one of the first people to interpret this music, and that's very different than, say, you're doing a Beethoven sonata that's been recorded and performed hundreds, thousands of times. You go on there and there's probably like at least 100 different recordings of like this, the same, I don't know, Beethoven Pathetique sonata, like all the great pianists have played it, every student. It's like a requirement to get into music school, like you have to play a Beethoven sonata, and so in many ways it's very freeing, knowing that you can approach this music with a blank slate and you can put the first brush strokes on the painting and you can color it. You have like the outline of it and you can choose how to color in the image, as a metaphor. And so yeah, I'll be performing the Philip Glass Piano Etudes Book Two. I came back to Vancouver 2 years ago to with Music on Main to perform Book One. These are a set of etudes. There are 20 of them, so 10 etudes in each book, written by the American composer Philip Glass. He's like 87 years old. And I released a recording of Book One 2 years ago in celebration of his 85th birthday. And so Book Two is really me finishing the cycle of this work that was written in that he started in the 90s, and he didn't finish it until like 2012. So they're really, really recent works. 20 years old, 30 years old. I first met Philip Glass maybe like 10 years ago or so. I play with an organization called Bang on a Can. I'm part of the Bang on a Can All Stars, which is an amplified sextet. Bang on a Can is started by three American composers, Julia Wolf, David Lang, and Michael Gordon. And we play their works and we also commission other people and et cetera. But Philip Glass is a close friend of Michael David and Julie, and the Bang on a Can All Stars had a concert. It was part of the Bang on a Can marathon, and Philip Glass joined the group to perform. So I actually played piano four hands with Philip Glass. That's when I first met him, and I was really nervous and I was totally fangirling. I didn't say anything to him because I was too shy. I just remember thinking, okay, I can't mess up here. And then fast forward in 2018, I was invited to perform at the Winnipeg New Music Festival, and they invited Philip Glass, and they decided to put on a concert of his complete etudes, all 20 etudes in one concert. It's about a 2 hour long, set of music. And it was Philip Glass, and they invited a few other pianists, myself, and other pianists, to each perform four of the etudes, four times five, and it was 20. So Philip performed, I performed, the other pianists performed. And that's how I first encountered these etudes. I completely fell in love with these pieces when I started working on it. When I had the opportunity to play up like acoustic piano music, things like without electronics, I can literally sit down and just play, and they're short, and they are not with a click track. There's room for, musicality, rubato, all that stuff that I can't do if I'm playing with a click track. Like I think I found another sense of freedom in the music. I decided from that moment on that I'm going to learn all 20 of them. You know, I heard it on that concert and I was like, I just really connected with it. So I learned them and then the pandemic happened. I recorded the pieces during the pandemic and then, you know, and then I released book one. And finally, I've recorded book two. It should be coming out later this year, on the same label, Cantaloupe. And if these are still relatively new pieces for me, like I've only performed book two maybe twice in the past few years, like in public with people. And I have to say that like my interpretation has changed over the years. Book two, musically is more challenging than book one. Book one is a lot more straightforward, musically speaking, and book two is just has a lot more room for interpretation, and it's a lot of harmonic changes, fast harmonic changes, and even just it's very cinematic sounding, and the techniques that he explores is just more layered, more intricate. And yeah, so like my rehearsal process, you know, now that the last time I performed book two was last summer. That was the second time I played it, and that was right before I recorded it. And so every time I pick it back up, I think I'm approaching it somewhat with fresh ears, or eyes, or that I'm finding something else in the music that I didn't find the last time I played it. I mean, it's interesting because I was listening to the recording that I did last summer, and I'm like, oh, interesting. That's what I did last time. Because this time around, when I started working on it the past few weeks, like I started doing different things, you know, and I'm like, oh, well, maybe I should re-record it now, you know, but it's like, oh, it's too late. I re already recorded it. But I guess it's just like working on any kind of music, like, you know, even in the traditional repertoire, you know, the more you work on it, the more depth and, you know, subtlety that you find. And so I think, yeah, I think the performance is going to be very interesting for me musically, because I am finding different things to highlight, different things in the music that I didn't before.
That is very interesting, and it makes me wonder. So you both said that you like are able to find these things that you hadn't found in previous plays, and also you mentioned the freedom of not having a click track when you're playing. Do you feel any type of pressure with this freedom when you know that the original composer of these pieces can hear your iteration, or is it more exciting? What does that feel like for you?
There are certain composers in the past that we know in history, like that wants their music to be played exactly the way that they want it, you know. And the way they show it is like in their notation. They write in every single articulation. They over notate. They dictate exactly the dynamics for almost every single note. Like that was a thing, you know. And that was a style of writing, you know, this like complete control. And when you look at Philip's scores, you don't see that at all. It's almost like, you know, seeing Bach, you know. He has some dynamics, you know, he has some tempo stuff, but it's very open. And I think he wants the performer to interpret the music. And I think this music needs to be interpreted. You know, even though these pieces are fairly new, there are many recordings out there of different people playing it. And what's really striking, I think, is that if you listen to all of our different recordings, everybody plays it differently. And that's so cool, you know, in some ways, you know, that there's not just one way of playing it. You know, if you put on a Mozart sonata, like most of the time, most of the recordings all sound the same. But you listen to these etudes, like everyone approaches it a little bit differently. Everybody shapes it differently, or maybe takes a little bit of, you know, the tempo a little bit different, just the whole feeling a little bit different. And I think that's really nice for the performer. There's no control from the composer to like try and control the performer. We want to have a sense of independence and freedom, you know, to add to it what we can, you know, contribute to the music. You know, it gives us a sense of agency, you know, to make music with the notes that he's written.
Yeah, I love that. And talking about composers, you mentioned a while ago that you commission composers and you work with composers. I guess, how do you balance this work with them? Because you know what you want, and then how do you, I guess, not get too involved with it?
Yeah, when I commission a composer, I am definitely not, you know, setting any limitations on, you know, like they have complete creative control as to what the piece is that they want to write. And usually when I am working with a composer, like I am working with someone that I feel like has that is like pretty fully formed, you know, that in terms of like their artistic voice or their artistic direction, they have a particular type of compositional style. And that's usually how I choose who I want to work with. And yeah, I definitely don't, you know, don't control anything. I don't dabble anything. Like, I think the magic of working with a composer, having them write for you, is that you're kind of like their muse-ish, you know, like because they are writing for you. I mean, maybe not all composers do this, and but I think like the best relationships with composer performer are the ones that do take this into consideration, is like who the performer is that's commissioning them. Because you do want to write a piece that would highlight them, that they like, that they want to play, that they like playing. And I think that's the type of collaboration is. And sometimes it's very different, you know, like there are some composers who I've worked with who, you know, don't contact me at all, and they literally just send me like a score and that's it. But most often, like 98% of the time, there's a lot of back and forth that they send me material, and they're like, hey, does this work? How does it fit? You know, blah, blah, blah. You know, what works, what doesn't work. Sometimes I work with a composer that may not know the piano so well, like that they may not have written for a piano. And so there's a lot of kind of maybe I do a little bit of editing, you know, like suggestions like, okay, this is not possible, or this will make it more pianistic and would fit better in the hands. Yeah, there, I think that's the thing that's like really cool, is really special, is that you're able to, you know, have a communication, you know, back and forth with in the creative process, and that knowing that the composer is taking into account like the type of performer you are and writing for you.
Yeah, that is very cool. Do you improvise at all? Or is that something that you do, you like, or you stick to playing what you know?
There was a period where I was improvising more. I would do like free improv, and I did some like free improv shows, but that is definitely like a genre of its own. You know, there are people who have spent years and years and years, you know, in perfecting their improvisation chops, and I haven't dedicated that time. And I think like right now I'm more focused on like learning repertoire, so I'm more just the interpreter. But I guess like, you know, if I was in a situation where I had to, then I can do it. But I also like respect this form of music making and creating so much that I wouldn't call myself an improviser. You know, some people, you know, it's like, oh, pianist, composer, improviser, educator, that all these things. And I don't feel like I can put that in my title just because I haven't dedicated enough time and practice into that practice. But I can. I can.
Yeah, I have no doubt about it. Yeah, I have a question. I don't know how to transition into it because I was kind of going through your Instagram and I saw that
Oh,
you
great.
have so No,
Oh, no.
don't worry. You have some big tattoos, both like on
Oh.
your back and on your leg. Yeah, nothing. Don't worry. This is a very chill question.
Okay.
And I feel like tattoos are such a big taboo in the performing arts world, was getting your first one like scary? Did you think it would affect you finding performing jobs? And also, are they mostly in like places that can't be really, they're not that visible? Yeah, I want to know about your tattoos.
No one's ever asked me about that. So the first one I got, it was actually it's on my wrist. So that one was, yeah, I felt like I wanted something that is visible but not like in your face. So I feel like if people are really looking and they, are concentrated, they can see something on my wrist, but they may not see it. And it's a very small tattoo. And now I have another one on my other wrist. Yeah, no, I think like because I'm in this new music world, contemporary music world, tons of people I know have massive tattoos, like ones that are like super visible. Like I know there's a cellist who has one like over her shoulder and like down her arm. It's really beautiful, but it's clearly very, very visible. We're not functioning in like traditional classical world. But even then, I feel like, I don't know, like there might be some gasps, when someone sees it, but I think mostly it's totally acceptable. I mean, I dye my hair and it's like blue, and I think like I want to have a little bit of a different look, especially since I am doing new music. But most of my tattoos you wouldn't really be able to see if I'm wearing concert attire. Like I have another one on the back of my arm, and sometimes you see that one a little bit. Like if I'm wearing short sleeves, it kind of peeks out. But yeah, I have eight
Nice.
tattoos.
Oh, that's great. And probably getting more.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, it's a little bit addictive.
I know, yeah. I'm limiting myself to one every year. I feel like that
Oh,
way I could, yeah.
how many
So
do
I
you?
oh, not that much. I have five.
Okay.
Yeah, I've been getting one on my birthday every year.
Oh, nice. That's a nice tradition.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a little birthday gift to myself. And I, as with everyone with tattoos, I just want to keep getting more. There's so many good artists, so many good designs, but limited space, unfortunately.
Yeah. I've heard of like tattoos that are like semi-permanent. I don't know if you've heard of this. Like apparently like you get it, but it fades away in like 1 or 2 years.
Interesting.
A little bit weird, but at the same time it's for people I guess who like don't really want to commit to it long term. It's not a temporary, it's a semi-permanent solution. So
Yeah. I feel like I would get too attached to it though.
yeah, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I saw the two big ones I saw, they were both floral.
Yeah.
Yeah, did you get them from the same artist?
Yes, those are both
Nice.
artists. I think she's kind of trapped. I think she's in LA now, but she was in here in New York for a bit. But yeah, those two took a very long time. I think the one on my thigh took like 12 hours or something. 'Cause she was doing like really fine line. Yeah, it took a long time.
Oh my
Yeah.
God. Yeah, multiple sessions, I'm assuming.
No, all in one go.
Oh
Yeah,
God. You are so strong. You have the patience that is required from both you and the artist. Insane.
impressed with her. Like actually, the one on my thigh, like it because. I start it, yeah, I didn't know it was gonna take that long. Like it was she started and then it just kept going. And I think it was like 1 in the morning or like 2 in the morning. I started at like 1 or 2 in the afternoon. And I was like, oh my gosh, okay. I can't because I was laying on my side and like my leg was like completely numb, it was hurting. And she didn't there was one more like butterfly that she, in her design that she needed to do. And it was probably going to take like another 15 minutes or something like that. But I was just like, okay, you know what? Just leave it. Like just you don't need to add that. It's totally fine without it. I stopped her. And she was like, it's just one more. And I'm like, no, I can't. I had to I reached my limit after 12 hours. Yeah, it was like 2 in the morning. It was kind of crazy.
That
Yeah.
is
Like, I
insane.
was committed. Like, I couldn't stop, you know, and she wasn't finished and she wasn't gonna stop.
I can't believe that, honestly. Oh my God.
Yeah, I mean,
How
I think
can you?
it was because she was using really fine line, you know, like super fine. Like, I think if she was using a bigger needle, it wouldn't have taken so long. But there was, it's just like, yeah, it was like the smallest freaking needle. And she was doing every, you know, like, yeah, I don't know why it took that long. Maybe she was just really slow. I don't know. But
Oh my God. What did you do for 12 hours? There's no way you spoke for 12 hours. You must have done some other stuff.
no, I just laid. I mean, well, actually, she didn't really speak English.
Oh.
So we didn't really talk. Yeah, I was just laying there.
Well, you were just kind of, you know, I not listening to anything, not watching anything. Oh my God.
Oh no. Yeah, that was rough. Yeah.
Wow, but you got through it. That is very impressive.
Yeah, it's totally worth it. I really like that tattoo. The one on my back,
Nice.
she also did. That took only like 6 hours. I don't know why that took less time. I don't know. But it's well yeah, but getting it on my back, it's kind of, you know, it's sad because I can't really see it. So
You ever forget that it's there?
yeah. Yeah. That's the only thing. That was the first bigger tattoo that I got. Yeah.
Yeah, wow, that is very cool. Anytime I go to get a tattoo, I cannot complain about how long it takes. I'm numb. Nope. Vicky sat through a tattoo for 12 hours.
Yep. Yeah.
Wow.
Everything is easy. You know, after that point, it's like, okay, totally fine. Sitting in traffic, totally fine. Sitting on a plane, totally fine. Yeah.
Totally okay. Oh, yeah. Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, I do not know how to transition out of this. I am just so shocked. Is there anything that you want to talk about more or you want to get into?
No, I think I kind of covered a lot of things. I'll share with you. I have a dog. I don't
Oh
know. You didn't ask me that, like, because I post a lot of photos of her on my Instagram. My dog Lola, she's gonna turn 13 actually next week. I've had her since she was like a 3-month-old. She's a little Shiba Inu.
Oh, happy birthday, Lola. That's so
She's
cute. Is she like with you in Brooklyn? Yes,
Yes.
I'm assuming. Yeah.
I
Cool.
sometimes when I come to Vancouver to visit my parents, like for the holidays and stuff, like I bring her with me. But unfortunately, this trip and the end of the month, I won't be bringing her with me because I'll be coming from another performance in Cincinnati, and that I'll be going to Toronto after for another performance. So I can't bring her with me this time.
Oh wow. Is it you've had her for so long? Do you like traveling for performances and such? Is it difficult being away from Lola? Or are you, I guess, used to it by now?
I'm used to it, and I'm glad that she's used to it as well, because you hear about dogs getting separation anxiety and then like not eating and stuff like that. But she's been, you know, since I got her, like I've always been touring and stuff, so I've had like, you know, she has lots of aunties and uncles that take care of her, and yeah, I've been very lucky that my friends have been able to help me when I'm gone. So she's very comfortable going to other people's apartments when I'm gone, and I think she likes it, you know. It's like a little vacation for her.
Nice. Yeah. She gets more treats than usual.
That's probably true. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. Well, thank you so much for coming on here talking with me. It was a great time. And I hope all the performances go smoothly. Everything goes well.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, and so nice to meet you, Sarah.
Yeah, it's really nice meeting you too.